The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of any organization, including One Generation Away.
The freedom of a people to choose its leaders is the root of liberty.
Keep alive this experiment in liberty.
Liberty, in case you've forgotten, is the soul's right to breathe.
Government should be very minimal in protecting liberty.
Peace cannot be purchased at the cost of liberty.
The sturdy ground of liberty.
Liberty once lost is lost forever.
Fight for their liberty and for our security.
Guarantees individual liberty.
This great republic born alone in liberty.
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 Just how much do you want liberty?
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
A production of LibertyNation.com.
Cutting through the double talk, taking on the topics, going after what the politicians really mean, and making it all clear. For your freedom and your liberty. Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
The circus comes to Washington, D.C. Oh, wait, it's been in town already for more than 2 years. Welcome back into Liberty Nation Radio, a production of LibertyNation.com and heard from coast to coast on the Radio America Network. And folks, if you want the definition of sleaze, we've got it for you. Michael Cohen, convicted liar at the center of a show trial for the absent President Trump, while Trump goes to Vietnam in search of a deal with North Korea but comes home with no deal. We'll bring on a couple of LibertyNation.com authors, legal affairs editor Scott Cosenza on the Cohen fiasco, and managing editor and international correspondent Mark Angelides on what happened between Trump and Kim Jong-un. Plus, how even liberals are now openly panicking about the Democrats going full-on socialist, and how a presidential election from over 40 years ago may well be a parallel to 2020.
Say what? Say what? Say what? One more time.
We kick things off with our signature segment, Say What, where we roll out some of the most wacky, astonishing, and damnable things uttered by politicians and the chattering class. The Democrats were just chomping at the bit to get the disgraced, convicted liar and former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen back in the spotlight, counting on him to say all manner of things about what an awful person the president is, and he cooperated fully, answering questions for 3 days, including 8 hours in a public session on Wednesday, and the Democrats dredged up every piece of dirt they could find on Trump and spread it around their members of their committee to ask questions on. Now, I'm not going to bore you with a whole lot of this, except for one clip that encapsulates the entire hearings and the kind of questions which had to leave ordinary folk wondering, is this what we sent these people to Washington for? This is Cohen and California Congresswoman Jackie Speier.
Did Mr. Trump tell you to offer Vladimir Putin a free penthouse? There is an elevator tape that has been referenced as a catch-and-kill product. It was evidently of Mr. Trump and a woman. Is there a love child? How many times did Mr. Trump ask you to threaten an individual or entity on his behalf?
Quite a few times.
50 times?
More.
100 times?
More.
200 times?
More.
500 times?
Probably.
Yes, that's what passes for a Democrat-led congressional investigation these days. And after the public hearing was over, Committee Chairman Elijah Cummings dropped a bombshell in answering a question from a reporter.
Do you believe that the president committed a crime while in office?
Based on what? Looking at the checks and listening to Mr. Cohen, it appears that he did.
Okay, well, that settles the issue now, doesn't it? They couldn't get him on Russia collusion, so they'll now be digging under every rock to uncover financial crimes. And if that doesn't work, they'll find something else. We'll talk more about this whole show trial or show hearing later on with LibertyNation.com legal affairs editor Scott Cosenza. Meanwhile, there was a remarkable exchange this week between California Senator Dianne Feinstein and a group of kids that were visiting her office in San Francisco, ranging from 10 years old up to maybe 16, maybe 18, that reveals everything you need to know about how our children are being taught that climate change is a mortal and immediate threat to the planet. And perhaps inspired by the young socialist sensation Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they demanded immediate and radical action.
We are trying to ask you to vote yes on the Green New Deal.
Well, there are reasons why I can't. Because there's no way to pay for it.
Yes, there is. Well,
that's, we have tons of money going to the military. Half of a lot of it is going to the military.
But we have come to a point where our Earth is dying, literally.
Some scientists have said that we have 12 years to turn this around.
Well, it's not going to get turned around in 10 years. What we can do,
Senator, if this doesn't get turned around in 10 years, at the faces of the people who are going to be living with these consequences.
The government is supposed to be for the people and by the people.
I've been doing this for 30 years. I know what I'm doing. You come in here and you say it has to be my way or the highway. I don't respond to that.
I told you, that says everything about the left circa 2019. There's no way to pay for it. But we spend all that money on the military. Our Earth is dying. The government is supposed to be for the people, by the people. The world is ending, and we don't care if the government seizes control of the whole economy and spends tens of trillions of dollars on the Green New Deal while the rest of the world continues using fossil fuels. We have to do it for the children. And you wonder why the suicide rate has increased so much. These kids being taught that the world is on the eve of destruction. Meanwhile, AOC said she may be 29 years old while Feinstein is 85, but that doesn't mean a thing.
I don't think that working on an issue for 30 years alone is what qualifies as what makes someone qualified to solve an issue. If you think that a carbon tax alone and no other intervention is going to fix climate change, you're part of the problem.
So now Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is attacking not just evil conservatives, but senior members of her own party in her infinite wisdom. And no one, not a single person in the Democratic Party, unless you count Feinstein, is willing to do or say one thing to stop her from dragging the party into full-on socialism. And let me tell you, they will come to regret that on Election Day 2020. Now, speaking of socialists, Bernie Sanders got into a bit of a pickle this week when he was asked about another radical socialist idea being floated by the Democrats, reparations for the descendants of slaves. He was asked about it at a town hall meeting on CNN.
Part of the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow in the U.S. is the legacy of income inequality in the U.S. What is your position on reparations to the descendants of slaves?
There are massive disparities that must be addressed. We have to do everything that we can to end institutional racism in this country. So we're going to do everything we can to put resources into distressed communities and improve lives for those people who have been hurt from the legacy of slavery.
So what is your position specifically on reparations? In 2016, you said it would be divisive, reparations.
Well, again, it depends on what the word means. And I know you don't want to be divisive tonight.
Whoops. Sounds a bit like depends what the meaning of is. But when Bernie's not busy talking about and hawking his socialist ideas, he lays out all the usual horrible things about Trump as if the other two dozen or so Democratic candidates won't do exactly the same thing.
It is unacceptable and un-American, to be frank with you, that we have a president who is a pathological liar, and it gives me no pleasure to say that, but it's true. We have a president who is a racist, who is a sexist, who is a xenophobe.
Oh my, he left out homophobe. Oh, and he left out Hitler. I'm sure that's about all you can take of leftists for now, so we'll take a break and come back to discuss the abrupt ending of talks between Trump and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un.
Exhausted by all the fake news? On LibertyNation.com's YouTube channel, facts and fresh, bold analysis are what you get without the leftist spin. Subscribe today to the LibertyNation.com YouTube channel because
truth,
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 truth
is
making
a
comeback.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
We believe that all men are entitled to blessings of liberty.
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run.
Mr. Trump goes to Hanoi and comes home empty-handed after his second summit with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. What went wrong? Or is Trump just playing a longer game? And what role might North Korea's benefactor China have played in the standoff in Vietnam? Joining us to analyze what happened and where Trump and Kim go from here is LibertyNation.com international correspondent and managing editor Mark Angelides, joining us from England. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Tim.
Thanks for joining. The elite media is using words like failure and collapse to describe the outcome of this summit. Are they right?
For those who are dead set against the president, this would have been a failure regardless. You just have to look at the last summit, which was an achievement in itself to actually have it. The more anti-Trump press, they saw it as a failure too, I guess. But it's definitely a success in terms of communication actually taking place. I'd say that's a good thing. And even after the walkout, Kim, he didn't retreat into threats and bluster and start launching his missiles again straight away, which is what we would have expected even just a couple of years ago. So for me, this is progress, regardless of anything else that's happened.
Now, Trump leaving the summit was somewhat reminiscent of when President Reagan walked out of his summit with Soviet President Gorbachev in Reykjavik back in 1986. But of course, the Soviets were a world power and North Korea's only significant because of their nuclear program. Gorbachev came back a year later with a proposal Reagan did accept. Do you think Trump's walkout is a tactical move in a longer term strategy?
You never can tell with President Trump, but sometimes he's very easy to read. Then you look again, he's literally just rewritten the whole rule book on what actually works. But whether or not it was part of the strategy, it's certainly part of a negotiation. You have to be willing to walk away if the cost or the ask is just too high. This is actually something my own Prime Minister, Theresa May, could do with learning with regards to negotiations with the EU.
We thought, most people, I think, that there were some things that were probably already settled before Trump and Kim arrived at the summit. So did you, like me, find it strange that there was no announcement of agreement on anything before Trump walked out?
Actually, not really, no. I don't know for sure what the civil servants had discussed in advance. If I were Donald Trump, and because of the reactions which I'd be expecting already from the world media, if I were him, I would not announce a single thing again until literally everything else is settled. You have hundreds, maybe thousands of North Korean security folk, and they're scouring the American press and the world press for hints and signals and whatnot for how it's being perceived in the international press.
Well, now the president famously put on a capitalist dog and pony show, for lack of a better word, for Kim Jong-un at their first summit with
you know, bringing out renderings of what a gleaming coastline he could develop in North Korea with hotels and restaurants and all the like. Do you surmise that Trump is pinning his hopes on convincing Kim that he could have a bright economic future like most every other country in Asia if he gives up his nuclear program in return for a healthy economic relationship with the U.S. and the rest of the West?
Actually, you know, I've thought about this question quite a lot. The incentives that Kim could be offered and, well, of course, what he would accept as well. The fact is that he's basically an emperor in North Korea. He can do anything he wants. He can have anything. And because he's got the nukes, nobody's going to stop him. So the idea of a booming tourist industry or a parade of Western real estate developers, that might not be enough to swing it. I think for Kim, he wants to rejoin the rest of the world. But in the back of his mind is Gaddafi, Libya's Gaddafi, who was humiliated, murdered by his own people I think it was Hillary Clinton laughing away in the background. So, I mean, if he's offered security for himself, his higher ups, and of course his fortune, I think that's what would bring North Korea back into the world, more so than the bright lights and the shining coastlines.
Now, we all know that North Korea is almost entirely dependent on China for its existence. They make 90% of their trade is with China. I mean, they are a client, they're a definitive client state of China. Now, this all coincides with President Trump delaying a new round of sanctions against China, which were scheduled to go into effect just this weekend. What hand do you think, hidden hand perhaps, might China be playing in this whole relationship between Trump and Kim?
Yeah, that's a wonderful perspective there, Tim. It is absolutely, it's not just a question of what's happening between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, it's what's happening with China. And delaying the already set trade sanctions and whatnot, this is clearly all part of one system. It's one system where if one piece goes out of balance, then the other piece goes out of balance. I would expect we're not going to hear much about China until something else comes out about North Korea in advance, just because, as you say, that they are literally a client state. Without China, there really isn't a North Korean economy, other than I think maybe 2% or something of fuels go to Russia. But without China's actual backing, there's really nothing Kim can do. So it's very much hand in glove.
Now, the Democrats deliberately scheduled their Michael Cohen show hearing for the exact same day Trump was meeting with Kim. I'm wondering if you think they succeeded in their goal of undercutting Trump and making Kim think he's vulnerable.
That's an interesting take. It could be that the Democrats were fearing a success in Vietnam. And with that they'd have this conquering victor, Donald Trump, coming back, having achieved what nobody else has ever dreamt possible within living memory. And then they'd have the Cohen testimony to lord over him, just to knock him down a peg or two. I think that was possibly one of the reasons for the timing there.
Okay, well, thanks for your contributions from over there across the pond. Appreciate it, Mark.
Much appreciated, Tim. Thank you.
Mark Angelides, LibertyNation.com. Quick break, and then with the Democrats heading in a full-on socialist direction, we'll come back to discuss an election from over 40 years ago that may be a predictor of what's to come in 2020.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Far more important than my political future and far more important than yours, the well-being of our country.
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Well, we are told in Scripture that there's nothing new under the sun. That's from Ecclesiastes. And if you live long enough, you come to realize the truth in that simple but power-packed piece of wisdom.
As we face the presidential election next year, consider the following political landscape. A Republican president reviled by the left and the media. The corresponding growth of a radical collectivist resistance. And a Democratic Party blinded by hate, overcome by nonsensical policy prescriptions driven purely by emotion, and consequently prepared to nominate a far-left candidate for president, somehow believing such a candidate could take down a despicable president elected by a previously silent majority. We're talking 2020, right? Actually, it was 1972. Richard Nixon had won a narrow victory in the presidential election 4 years earlier in 1968 when the nation was ripped apart by the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy and race riots across the land and growing protests over the Vietnam War. Revolution was in the air. Nixon appealed to voters who were turning against the war but rejected the growing violence and anti-Americanism in both the anti-war and hippie movements, which shook the country to its core and threatened the status quo. Once Nixon captured the White House, the resistance turned up the heat. And in 1972, a senator from the far-left fringe of the Democratic Party, George McGovern, wrested the presidential nomination from establishment figures Ed Muskie and Hubert Humphrey and, believe it or not, segregationist George Wallace. Yes, in those days, the Democratic Party was more, shall we say, eclectic. Wallace was the victim, actually, of an assassination attempt while he was campaigning, and it turned him into a paraplegic, though incredibly, he won primaries in Maryland and Michigan the day after the assassination attempt. But the establishment candidate split the vote, allowing McGovern to seize the nomination and face Nixon in the general election. Now, both Nixon and Trump were positioned by the left as radical conservatives, when in fact, both of them supported multiple positions that were in accord with left-of-center thinking. In addition to his groundbreaking policy of détente with the Soviet communists and historic reestablishment of relations with China, few are aware that Nixon ended the military draft, established the Environmental Protection Agency, signed Title IX restrictions outlawing gender bias, and implemented wage and price controls. But none of that mattered because the left believed Nixon to be evil. Now, Trump has decried the Iraq war and followed a non-interventionist foreign policy, which the left has historically favored. He's opened negotiations with the North Korean communist regime, initiated trade deals which protect American unions. He supported criminal justice reform, campaign finance reform, infrastructure bailout, and protection for entitlement programs such as Social Security. But like Nixon, those positions are of little, if any, consequence to leftists repulsed by this 45th president. Now, a lot can change in the 20 months leading up to the next election, but the similarities between 1972 and 2020 are striking. The current president is even more despised than Nixon. The resistance is similarly full-throated, and the Democrats appear hell-bent on delivering their nomination to one of a boatload of candidates tripping all over themselves to prove they're further left than the rest of the pack, that they hate Trump the most and can check the most intersectional, that would be identity politics, boxes. In 2016, the Democrats tipped the scales in favor of the establishment candidate Hillary Clinton in her battle with Bernie Sanders, just as they had done in 1968, in both cases infuriating their political base. So in 2020, just as in 1972, the party eliminated the rules which provided a built-in advantage for party regulars. Now, McGovern, pouncing on the new primary configuration, supported unilateral withdrawal from Vietnam, dramatic reductions in the military budget, and an overhaul of the welfare system in favor of a so-called guaranteed income for all Americans. The Democratic field for 2020 favors all manner of government guarantees, free income, free health care, free college, among other things. And of course, there's the Green New Deal supported by the entire current top tier of candidates, which would shift control of the entire economy to the federal government at a cost of tens of trillions of dollars. Yes, folks, we have seen this movie before. And oh, by the way, the result of the 72 election? Nixon won the popular vote by 62-38% and captured 49 out of 50 states. The resistance wing of the Democratic Party receives most all of the attention these days, but don't kid yourself. There are millions of standard-issue Democrats who want their party to win, but are actually more concerned about the state of the nation than with taking down Donald Trump at any cost or resorting to socialism to draw as sharp a contrast as possible with this president. But with all their talk of the Democrats' increasingly radical base and identity politics and the social justice movement, the legacy media is putting the fear of God in the party's traditional rank and file who see Trump as vulnerable but are watching their party's standing increasingly threatened with each new discussion about abolishing ICE or the Green New Deal or reparations or free everything. Even the longtime liberal columnist at the Washington Post, Richard Cohen, wrote a column this week entitled "Democrats Are Handing Trump a Gift," in which he wrote that the party is headed for electoral hell in a handbasket with all their talk about socialism and reparations. Now, you would ordinarily conclude that the party will come to its senses and nominate a candidate who, at a minimum, doesn't scare the bejesus out of ordinary folk. But how many of their current or prospective candidates meet that qualification? Joe Biden? Sure. If you want to go with a white guy who's crested at 1% in two previous bids for the White House, there's John Kerry, loser to George W. Bush 15 years ago, and if nothing else, a big-time beneficiary of white privilege. Remember his windsurfing in Nantucket in the 2004 campaign? Then there's Michael Bloomberg, former New York City mayor, who's one of the very few in his newfound party to defend capitalism, euphemistically calling the Green New Deal unrealistic. But at this point, there's hardly a groundswell for any of that trio or any kind of moderate. Quite the opposite. Kamala Harris, nominal frontrunner at this point, fully intersectional, supporter of the Green New Deal and reparations, is the new Democratic norm. Democrats are all jacked up after winning the House in the 2018 midterms, but they are misinterpreting their mandate and dramatically overestimating the popularity of their agenda. They seem to have forgotten how they had to tamp down and undersell their socialist vision in the days leading up to the 2018 midterms in order to win. But given all the socialist water that's passed under the bridge in the almost 4 months since then, it may now be impossible for them to do the same in 2020. We'll take a quick break and then come back and analyze the circus that was the Michael Cohen hearings in Washington this week.
Exhausted by all the fake news? On LibertyNation.com's YouTube channel, facts and fresh, bold analysis are what you get without the leftist spin. Subscribe today to the LibertyNation.com YouTube channel because
truth
is
making a
comeback.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Just talking loud, just saying nothing.
It was a show trial to end all show trials, only the defendant, Donald Trump, was in absentia. Michael Cohen, former lawyer for Donald Trump, convicted liar, ready to spend 3 years in the slammer, seemingly the opposite of a credible witness. In fact, perhaps the least credible witness I have personally ever seen testify before Congress, was brought before a House committee to respond to virtually every allegation made against Trump over the years, a clear opportunity for the Democrats to again demonstrate how far they'll go to take down this president. And they deliberately held the hearing just as the president was meeting with the North Korean leader trying to get a deal to make the world safer, if only by a bit. Proving once again the Democrats care far more about kneecapping Trump than anything else, including national security. That all said, did this amount to something, nothing, or somewhere in between? Was there actually anything new in this hearing? Joining us to analyze is LibertyNation.com legal affairs editor Scott Cosenza, who wrote an excellent piece on LibertyNation.com in which he decried how a lawyer like Cohen would willingly violate the relationship with his client, violate attorney-client privilege, and rat out his client. So, Scott, jump in here. What say you?
Well, that... You know, the attorney-client privilege is a privilege that a client can assert in a proceeding against him to say, well, you can't introduce evidence against me. This goes beyond that, and it's more of a professional duty and an ethical obligation that we have as attorneys to not violate the confidences of our clients, and that's why they hire us. If we wouldn't keep their confidences, they wouldn't pay us, the high wages that that attorneys make. And so... I think it's really odious, and I just can't believe that he did it, Tim. It's one thing if he was under threat of compulsion or something like that, which, while I don't think would be great, is forgivable. But that's not what we have here. This is just Michael Cohen, it seems like, at the beck and call of Lanny Davis in a move to try and eliminate Donald Trump because Hillary Clinton was supposed to be president and Donald Trump is now.
If you listen to his closing statement, which I know you did, Scott, that could have been written by Hillary Clinton. I mean, and Lanny Davis is his lawyer, and Lanny Davis is an old time, big time friend of the Clintons. I mean, he's saying he's afraid that Donald Trump won't turn over the reins of power if he loses a 2020 election.
How horrible that was, you know. The idea that Trump is somehow prepared to move into some Maduro-like despotic position in the United States is a laugh track if it weren't being played out in the halls of Congress, Tim.
Well, now that Russian collusion appears to be out the window by most all accounts, they've now moved on to financial fraud, you know, whatever it takes, Scott. So what did they get, if anything, on financial fraud that the special prosecutor in the Southern District of New York don't already have?
Well, we learned some facts through the presentation at the hearing yesterday that certainly those prosecutors already know, but they weren't publicly disclosed. Michael Cohen detailed the inflation of value of properties for some insurance purposes and deflation for perhaps tax purposes. Basically, some fudging of numbers to increase profits, it seems like. It all seemed relatively minor, yet perhaps criminal. So we'll see about that. And the other thing, Tim, is Michael Cohen, and this was drawn out by Eleanor Holmes Norton, the Washington, D.C. rep, who does not have a vote in Congress, but she does have a seat on the committee. And she drilled down onto Trump's motivation for the Stormy Daniels payment. You'll remember we've spoken on this program before. It's Trump's own motivations, which may or may not make that payment a criminal violation, or not, maybe not, criminal violation of the nation's campaign finance rules.
You know, Scott, there's an expression in legal circles based on an important Supreme Court decision, which refers to prurient interest. And it seemed to me that was the catchword for what the Democrats were doing. They picked every unflattering story, it seemed, from here back to, 10 years ago,
And it seemed like they divided that up among the Democratic members of the committee. You know, they brought up the Moscow hotel, the elevator videos, a love child. I mean, nothing mm-hmm. was beneath the dignity of the people running this committee. Or am I overstating it?
Oh, you're understating it. I thought the most odious part was the insulting of Donald Trump Jr. And a line that where Trump in an episode of frustration, insulted his judgment to Michael Cohen. And he made sure to relay that before the committee as if that's somehow a proper place to examine, the relief. I mean, it's just beyond the pale, Tim. Honestly, it was just 7.5 or 8 hours of craziness. You know, I called my story a dumpster fire on the Hill for a reason. I thought it resembled that on multiple fronts.
Yeah, that was the best description that I'd heard of it. What does it say about Michael Cohen that he's describing all these things that he did, these dirty deeds that he did for Trump over the years? They asked him, how many times did he ask you to?
Oh, right. Yeah. Let me
to threaten somebody. Yeah. And they did, like, it was like an auction. Do I hear 50? Do I hear 50? No. Do I hear 100? Do I hear 200?
Yeah. And by the way, they breezed through threat. Like, I think that, I saw an ABC News presentation this morning, Tim, online that said that, the takeaway or highlights from the Cohen hearing. And they breezed through the fact that the threats are legal threats, as in, if you release these things that are supposed to be private, I will sue you, or I will do this. Not, we're going to send people over to break your legs, which I think it had the sort of veneer of that as they were going on about it.
Yeah, no question. But I mean, here's Cohen, who did all these things for all these years, all these terrible things, according to him. And now he's convicted of lying to Congress, lying to investigators. He's going to jail for 3 years, and he appears before the committee, and we're supposed to believe that has even a shred of credibility? I mean, the Democrats have engaged in wishful thinking about it. They've said, I think he was a rather credible witness.
I think that most people lie from time to time and about important things from time to time. I think that's true for the president. I think that's true for Mr. Cohen. And, it's a tough thing to sort of grant somebody a sort of a general credibility or general incredibility. It's important to examine the motivations for all these statements. But one thing I want to say, Tim, is there seems to be a potential, and I haven't investigated this fully yet, but for Michael Cohen to be charged again with perjury. And this has to do with his statements to the committee that he was not interested in a job in the White House. Republicans brought forth this idea under the theory that this is sour grapes, which is to say that Michael Cohen wanted a esteemed position in the White House. He was denied that position. And part of this is sort of a revenge play. He adamantly disputed that, said he did not want at any time a job in the White House. And that was then refuted by a number of people. So there's a potential for more criminal charges coming his way.
Oh, so let's talk about where things go from here. By most accounts, the Mueller report is going to be coming out presently, shortly, in the next week, month, something like that. I mean, we don't necessarily have any proof of that, but the indications are that it will. But when the Mueller report is out, we've still got the Southern District of New York, which is independent from the special counsel. So what liability might Trump have in terms of any investigations from the Southern District of New York?
Oh, it's a hodgepodge. You talked about the financial crimes, and that was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's moment in the sun before the committee. And she didn't say anything particularly wacky. She went into that valuation. So there's potential criminality there. And if you know how these things work, it would be a crime, a fraud crime with potential with the government and insurance companies, not to mention if somebody signed that paper and put it in the mail, you've got mail fraud. So there are multiple criminal possibilities.
They still haven't accepted the fact that Donald Trump got over 60 million votes and was duly elected by the American people, and they're going to prove it in any way they can. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Tim.
This program, Liberty Nation Radio Plus, LibertyNation.com's own podcast, The Uprising, hosted by Scott and occasionally Lisa K. Donner and me will join him. All available on demand at LibertyNation.com and from fine podcast providers everywhere. So that is it for this week, but we'll be back at you next week, same time, same station. Till then, this is Tim Donner saying, stand up for liberty. And we'll see you next time on Liberty Nation Radio.